the UCR Podcast.
Former Eagles guitarist Don Felder is one of those guys who always has a bunch of interesting stories to share. He recently celebrated his 50th year in the business in an interesting way by digging through his archives, pulling out song ideas that were never finished for one reason or another, including some songs that he wrote with the Eagles in mind. He took the ideas, wrote new songs, and then he wrote more new songs fresh from his Felder brain on top of that. The result is Don's latest solo album called The Vault, 50 Years of Music, and that is available now wherever you get your tunes. I spoke with Don to dig into the story behind some of the songs, and Don shares some tales from other songs in his catalog, including Those Shoes by the Eagles and the song that he wrote when he was looking to write his next Hotel California, and the way the world ended up hearing it happened in an interesting way. Don is on the road as we speak, touring with Styx and the Kevin Cronin Band as part of the Brotherhood of Rock tour. It was a real pleasure, as always, to speak with Don. If this is your first time listening to the UCR podcast, you can find lots more regarding Don Felder and also the Eagles in general at Ultimate Classic Rock. Make sure you follow us here as well so that you will get future episodes as they are released. Here's our conversation with Don Felder. And this new album seems like it would must have been a lot of fun to put together. Like, how did you first come up with the idea to pursue this particular concept in honor of your 50 years in the business?
It wasn't anything that was ever planned. I just had lived out in Malibu for 29 years, went through five major fires out there. And after the last one, I said, that's it. I'm getting out of here before I get burned down. So I took my studio, my console, my 24-track machines, my 4-track Ampex, my 2-track Ampex, put them all in a storage unit. And I had tons of cassettes and CDs and ADATs, all the different formats you could imagine over the last 50 years. And so we just threw them all in this box and put them in storage. And about 4 or 5 years ago, that was 2000 when I moved in from Malibu to LA. And so I said, I don't even know what's in that stuff. Let me at least go look at this stuff, see what's here. So when I walked in, I started seeing all these 24-track tapes of songs that I had recorded and one-inch, 16-track tape that I made a lot of my old demos on, quarter-inch tapes that were for mixing down and stuff, and this box of cassettes and ADATs and everything that probably had 200 tapes in it. I said, I don't even know what this stuff is. So I took that box and brought it back to my studio. And my engineer and I transferred them from cassette because, as you know, over the years, it'll start shedding the oxide on it, you know, and it just won't play. So we got it one pass and we recorded everything digitally, but we only did about 20 of them. And out of those 20, I had heard 4 or 5 really great original ideas that were just demos. One of them was this idea that I started in 1974 or 75, right after I joined the Eagles. And my friend Bernie Lydon said, if you want to write songs for the Eagles, just write music beds, you know, intro, verse, chorus, solo, chorus, out, you know, song structure, right? And give those, no vocals, no lyrics, just give those music beds to Don and Glenn, and they'll write the lyrics and they'll write the melody because they're going to be the singers, right? So I had boxes of just rough music bed ideas. Like for Hotel California, I think I wrote 16 or 17 different song ideas. Two of them wound up on the record. Hotel was one of them, and Victim of Love was another. And the same thing for The Long Run. I had 2 songs on that. One was Disco Strangler and Those Shoes. So I was looking at this box and I really want to hear what all this stuff is, you know? So when we started playing them, I found about 5 or 6 really nice progressions, just music bits, no lyrics, no nothing. And I said, I should take those songs and just finish, redo them. And if they turn out great, we'll put out a record. If not, we'll just go write a bunch of new stuff. So it was just fun looking back at the very first demo. I didn't have any drums. There were no drum machines back there that you could use on a track like that. So I got a cardboard box and put a microphone in front of it and went, and played about 3 minutes of me banging on a cardboard box. And that was my drum track. And I had a bass. I played bass and rhythm guitar. And then I played slide guitar on it because this was right after I was asked to join the band. And they loved my slide playing. So I played slide on it. And when I heard that, I went, well, we could do a lot better than a cardboard box now. But I love that slide figure that I was playing. So I decided I would do that again and bring it from just a rough cardboard box demo up to high-tech 96K Pro Tools today. And it was funny because Henley, when he heard it, he said, I like that. We should write a song about slide on. And I went, no, that sounds too corny. It really is too corny. So when I looked at it, I remembered he thought it should be slide on. I said, no, no, let's make this move on. Where you go through a relationship, it gets bad, it breaks up, just it's time to move on. You know, so everybody's been through that at one point or another in their life. I'm certain they could relate to that.
Yeah, and that's a song that, as you have shared, like Henley liked what he heard. Was it just as simple as disagreeing over the direction title-wise, or how did that song not make the cut? Do you remember?
It never got past Cardboard Box, that demo. It was just, that's as far as it got. And typically, we would only have a certain amount of time in the studio to record a full album's worth. And we were so particular about every note that went on those recordings. They just had to be as close to perfect as humanly possible. There was no Pro Tools. There was no auto tune. There was no digitally correcting, none of that stuff. You just had to have great performances. And so that was the key to those things. And when you take something that's just kind of half written and it's a cardboard box, it's hard to translate that into what an Eagles record should sound like. But we just never even cut a basic track for it.
Yeah. And, you know, you said something important that I think is important for songwriters within the band setting to learn is, I hear this a lot from various folks, that they have to learn, like, how do the collaborators like things? Do they like you to bring in songs that are nearly completed? More often than not, as we know, it's like they would prefer for you to bring in, as you described, songs that are still available to kind of be molded into whatever the final thing is going to be. But it's interesting to me, like listening to Hollywood Victim, for example, that dates back to the Hell Freezes Over period, but it has like a certain vibe that really feels more like classic Eagles that we could have heard like in the 70s or something like that. And so you've laid out kind of the parameters of how Bernie told you would be good to bring in songs, but what do you think you learned eventually about writing for the Eagles that would put your material in the right zone to get a song like Hotel California on the record, Victim of Love, Disco Strangler, and so on? Because you found the formula clearly that like would get your, you know, songs past the finish line.
Well, I learned that I had to write simply enough so that Don Henley could play drums and sing. So I used to play drums on all my demos as I finally got up to 16 track instead of having some drum machine playing it. No, I'd write the drum part especially for songs like Those Shoes. That was a complicated, difficult drum part to play and sing at the same time. And I salute Don for learning how to do that. But of all the drummers that sing that I know, he's the best at rubbing his tummy and patting his head at the same time. He just disconnects what is playing and just sings, you know. So he's just great at that. But typically I would write songs that were easy enough and simple enough that Don could sing and play them. It was like if you're writing for a cast of characters for a sitcom, you know how these characters are supposed to be and what makes them funny and what makes the straight guy straight. So you'd write the script for those characters. That's kind of what I learned to do, was write scripts for the guys in the Eagles.
You mentioned Those Shoes. Like, how far did that evolve from where it started? Like, because it's got a very cool sound to it. Like, how much of that was there in the original demo that you submitted at the time?
I think everything was there except the live solo. And Joe had joined the band, and we had been, you know, working together with Hotel California tour and all that stuff. The Eagles never had a song that had a talk box on it. Joe was a brilliant talk box player. So I thought, why don't I write something that's like two trumpets playing? ba 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 ba, right, in harmony. And so we both got to play talk boxes while Henley sang and played that crazy drum beat, and could sing it. So it was really aimed at exactly what I had hoped it would become, is Joe and I playing talk box on a record. Now, Hotel California, the original demo was the same way. Joe and I had been playing together previously, in Joe Walsh and Friends. I think we played at Dodger Stadium and opened for Elton John, and we played Don, I think it was Don Kirshner's rock concert or something, where we just jammed together. It was fun. We had a great time. So when Joe joined the band, I wanted to write something that Joe and I could do what we were doing before, but on an Eagles record. And so Hotel California was the idea, in my mind, of having the end of this thing end up being guitar solos. And so the old original cassette demo is pretty much exactly like it is. I played the 12 string acoustic, I wrote the bass part for it, the descending harmony lines, the reggae part, chick, 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 the reggae part on it. Just all the parts to it were there. And when we got to the end, I said, I'd play something kind of like this. And Joe would play something like that. I'd answer him with a Strat, and I would play my Les Paul, and he'd play a Strat or a Tele. And I was just simulating roughly what it should be. But I was trying to write for the characters in that sitcom, to tell you the truth, right? For stuff that Joe and I could do together, songs that Don could sing and play drums simply enough on. And that's what I learned about writing for that group.
You mentioned Elton. Did you meet Elton at that time?
Absolutely, yeah. He actually sat in with us when we did the Hotel California tour, and we played the Forum here. This was before they had any of the big fancy arenas. We played the Forum, and he came out and sat in at the very end of our encore. It was great. He's just a really nice guy. We had done Wembley Stadium together with him. I think 120,000 people were there with the Eagles and Elton John, and it was just really fun working with him. Such a great guy and a brilliant, brilliant entertainer and keyboard player and singer. Anyway, we love Elton. He's fantastic.
They've said that different people have different ways of dealing with playing in front of big crowds like that. What was the science that you found for not freaking out that there's 120,000 people out there?
Well, I used to go down when I was 10 years old to the Florida Theater every Saturday. And they had a Saturday matinee that you could get in for a quarter. And before the Saturday matinee started with the cartoons and stuff, and then the movie they kind of show, they had a talent scout, or they had a talent contest. I'd go down every Saturday, get up on stage and play just myself and a guitar and sing. And I think I won three or four times, to tell you the truth, but I didn't care about the winning. I just got really comfortable about walking out on stage. So it doesn't really matter if you're playing for somebody's birthday party and there's eight people there, or you're playing Wembley Stadium and there's 120,000 people there. I just love to play the music. It's not the size of the audience. The only time I've been really nervous about stepping out on stage and playing was that when we had this event at the Metropolitan Museum of Art that had the just, I think it was called the Play It Loud. And
Yep.
it had all the greatest guitars in the history of rock and roll. And so Jimmy Page was there. They asked me if I would come out and play a little bit of Hotel for the press. There were about 200 press jammed in this room at a stage about the size of your desk for me to walk out on. And so I went, sure, I'll do that. So I walked out, and sitting right in front of me, literally right at my feet, was Jimmy Page. And I said, oh Lord, please don't let me mess up. I'll ride in the middle of the night with anxiety if I screw this up. Please don't let me screw this up. So I went out and played, and I was just holding my breath. Not about the press. I've played in front of the press for decades, right? But with Jimmy, I was like, oh no, don't, why do I have to wade through this one? Anyway, we got through it, hugged each other. He complimented me on my playing, and I said, well, you're the other double night player that I admire myself.
You know, in one sense, I guess song ideas are song ideas, but like Free at Last is the first thing that people heard off this record. And that's one of the new songs that you wrote for this record. And like, so I just wondered, like, Was it any sort of process making, the quote unquote new stuff fit with, some of the old ideas, or did it all really kind of gel pretty well from where you were sitting?
Well, one of the things that I tried to do was cast the tracks with the right players. I've known all of these players on this record for decades, guys from Toto and Nathan East and Greg Phillinganes. I mean, we go back, into the 80s and 70s together, working on projects and, just hanging out. So I know exactly how these guys play, how they feel. Who would be the best place bass player to cast on this particular track? And so, or a drummer like Jim Keltner played on this one, "Let Me Down Easy," and he was the perfect drummer for that. He's just classic that way. And yet, Todd Zukerman played on "I Like the Things You Do." Why? Because Jaden, my girlfriend, who that song was written about, love Todd Zukerman. She would go when we were playing with the sticks. She would go backstage, and there's a little hole behind the drummer where Todd's sitting on the other side, so his drum tech can watch him if he drops drumsticks or something. He's got a problem, so she would go back there and watch Todd. And she just loved his aggressive. So I said, "Well, who would you like to play on this?" She said, "Todd Zukerman." So like that, and it was the perfect call for that track, So. It's really comes down to casting when you know people like Lukather. I've known him since the 70s, like I said, and he comes over, and the first 45 minutes we're just telling jokes and stories and laughing and having a great time, recounting a bunch of stuff that's happened in our lives together. And after that, we spend 30 minutes recording and it's done. I mean, we spend more time just hanging out and catching up and having fun than it takes to actually write and record the parts. That's the easy part, So we get to, and David Page, the same thing, Page will come over or I'll go to his studio and I know exactly how he plays. Great B3 player, electric piano, grand piano. If it's got keys, he's just phenomenal at it. So I know how these guys play and work, and so I cast what I think would be the right call for the part.
This record seems like it, in that way, kind of unfolded a little bit casually, just the way it came together. Like, did it kind of unfold in that fashion?
Yeah, there was never any intent when I started out to do what happened with turning all these older ideas into current reproductions, but finished product, with lyrics and melody, and me singing and background, and all that. None of that existed. If nothing else, some of them, like Move On, really was maybe a minute long. The demo is just hardly anything. That's as long as I could play that cardboard box before my hands got tired. So it was just a short demo, but it just seemed like it was an interesting challenge to take me from 74 or 75 ideas and have me put them together in today's fashion. And I tried to, there's only one song on there to me that still sounds like it's from that era of the 80s, and it's "All Girls Love to Dance," because it's got that walking Moog bass part in it, which was on the demo. There were no lyrics, there were no, anything. It was just this kind of cool, drum machine and Moog part. And I wanted to do it justice by keeping it in the 80s instead of having a real bass player, play on it. So that's the only one that really stayed in its decade, I think.
Some of this stuff was intended for Eagles Records. What's kind of the history of some of this other stuff, as far as what you thought you might do with it at the time, if you had thoughts of doing something with it at the time? Is there one that kind of got away?
Well, I would say that, one that got away was I wrote this really heavy track to follow up Hotel California, that Joe and I could play ascending chromatic scales and harmonies and trade-off solos. We got in the studio and we cut a track of it, and that was probably the heaviest thing that the Eagles had ever attempted to play. And we just cut the basic track, and it was for the long run. And we got down to the very end of the amount of time we had set aside to finish this record. No lyrics, no vocals, no guitar solos, just basic track. And we had to leave and go on tour for the long run tour. We were just done. We were jamming to try to get this stuff finished, mixed, done. We just didn't have time to finish it. So Years later, I get a call from a movie director who wants me to write a song for an animated movie. So I go over and watch this movie, Heavy Metal, and I go, well, I've got a pretty strong, heavy track that I wrote and recorded for the Eagles. And at the time, it was called its nickname, since we used to have these working titles. The nickname for that track was "You're Really High, Aren't You?" So
Awesome.
most of the time, probably. Anyway, it never got made in anything. So when I got back to my house after looking at that movie, I thought I should take that idea, which never got finished, and make it into another track. So I really rewrote it, pretty much with the same intent. If you listen to heavy metal, you can imagine Joe and I playing those harmonies, yeah, da da da, do 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 do, right? And the trading off solos would have been perfect. So I just kind of took that same idea and did it for that movie. It worked out great.
Yeah, what do you recall? Like, obviously, well, that's kind of the cool thing is that is one of the people that that's one of the things that people will hear on this record that they have heard before because many people at this point have heard heavy metal. But at the time, what was it like putting that song together? Because, like, just the intro alone is super cool the way it begins. So I wonder what the process, like, sonically was like of building that at the time.
I came up with the idea of having these guitar power chords and these single note sustain notes that go, and it's backwards. We just hit the downbeat and let them ring out, and then we flipped them around so they started, the sound of it was backwards. So it was just a recording technique, not really use that much, but I thought it has to have a special introduction, and that really is what did it.
It's got a really, even now, it's got a really cool, like when you hear the version that is on this new record, like it just has a very cool, like futuristic sound to it, which of course fits the tone of the project that it ended up on originally, but it's just a very cool sounding song for the time.
When I had heard heavy metal, the original one from 81 or 82, 83, whatever it was, it just sounded a little damp. It just didn't have today's modern crispness and 96K, and phonetically, fidelity wise, it just didn't sound today. It sounded dated. So I thought I should take that song idea and make it today's technology. Even though I do still use a lot of old classic microphones like C12, 251, 49s. I have 14 1083 Neve mic preamps that I bought out of a console in Germany, old API mic preamps. I still use a lot of classic A front end for the mics recording into digital. And to me, that's what gives it that kind of warmer sound instead of using everything solid state, mic pre's and all that stuff. I still like the warmth of analog that's transferred into digital. And I thought
So I'm.
the redo of it came out sounding great, a lot better than the original version did to me.
It's fun to be able to kind of go back and kind of get it right in a sense that way.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we talked about Hollywood Victim earlier. Going back to that one for a second, tell me about what the demo for that one was like and how it kind of progressed to what we're hearing on this record.
There was no title for it. It was just the track. And again, it was a submission that myself, Timothy Schmidt, Max Carl, and a really famous English singer were putting together a
Paul Carrick,
band.
right?
Paul Carey, that's right. We were putting together a band, and Paul came in with this song. We were making demos, right? And he came in with this song, and we recorded it with him singing and all of us singing the backgrounds, and the solo on it and everything was exactly like it was when we went in to do Hell Freezes Over. And that song, Love Will Keep Us Alive, was re-recorded from our old demos, except instead of Paul singing it, who absolutely, I love his voice to death, Timothy wanted to sing it. And so we rebuilt the entire track ground up. Acoustic guitar, slide guitar solo, everything exactly like the demo, except Timothy sang. Same key, even. So it's interesting that some of the things that, demos from one stage of my life for another wound up being on Eagles records or wound up in the vault somewhere that I would discover later.
How'd you meet Paul Carrick originally?
I had been an admirer of him for many, many years. His voice was just really one of those kind of voices that you hear as soon as you hear him sing, you know who it is. It's like Henley or Rod Stewart. As soon as you hear him, you know they have a very identifiable, unique voice. Plus, he has a lot of soul in his playing and singing. Just I had admired him for a long time. So when we were working with Timothy and Max Carl about putting together this band, Irving suggested Paul Carrick, and I said, great, fly him over here. So he would stay at my guest house or on my yacht up in Oxnard Marina, which he really enjoyed, drive into the studio and would work. And he loved being in California instead of England. So Paul is just a brilliant guy. I love him to death.
One of the things we've been talking to people about is obviously Ozzy Osbourne is going to play his final show this summer. So I just wondered, I think that you crossed paths perhaps with Sabbath at some point, but just generally, I wondered, you know, as a player and a creative person, what do you appreciate about Ozzy and Black Sabbath and their legacy?
To me, they came up with a kind of an unfounded genre, that really heavy, heavy, black, dark power metal. In my opinion, that did not exist until they showed up on the scene. And then a whole new wave, a whole new avenue of rock music was born out of their original albums and music. And it was just fantastic to see that. Not anything that I particularly like or want to play. Definitely inappropriate for the Eagles to tell you the truth. But I really admire anybody that's got such a unique approach to music, and it stands out way above everybody else. You know, it's just so unique, you can't help but like it.
You mentioned Jimmy Page early on. What sort of influence did you take from Jimmy early on, you know, as a guitar player?
I wouldn't say that I really followed Jimmy very much. I mean, everybody has heard his playing and stuff, but I never sat down and copped his licks. I don't do. But I take inspiration from him in how much enthusiasm he has in his playing. And to me, that's a really important thing. If you are really committed, it reminds me of Tommy Petty when he was little. He was probably 15 or 16. He had this band who I used to call the Rucker Brothers. And it was two brothers, Ricky and Rodney Rucker. Say that fast three times in a row. Ricky, Rodney Rucker. Anyway, and he would walk out on stage playing bass. This is before he got to play guitar. He walked out on the road playing bass, and his conviction on stage, his just absolute confidence, even if he's singing a little out of tune or he's singing a little whiny like Bob Dylan, it didn't matter. He sold you on his confidence. And I remember being at a show because I was helping his two horrible guitar players. Look, you play rhythm. When Tom's singing, you don't, the other guitar player, you don't play. When Tom stops singing, you can play your solo, but just don't play solo all the way through the whole song. Yeah. So anyway, I was standing in the audience next to three or four young girls. Why? I don't know, but I was.
It was a good move.
And I heard the girls say, "Oh my God, he's so great. Look at that." And he's flipping his hair and just rocking away out there. And he sold you. You didn't even have to hear him. Just his conviction, and that's what I felt about Page. He was a great player, great studio musician, but his commitment, his confidence in what he was doing, and his absolute just energy that he put into it was amazing. To me, Hendrix is the same way. His playing was just he was just out of control. I mean, just he came across. There was never a spark of lack of confidence or, you know, in any way, it just didn't exist. He just came out and nailed it. So that's what one thing I do admire most about Jimmy.
Closing out here with one more thing about the vault. And that just is, you mentioned Jim Keltner. How did you first meet Jim? What's the story there?
Wow. Well, we were around backstage in different shows all through the 70s, depending on who he was playing with. And obviously, I admired his track record, I guess is the way to put it. All the songs he had played on the records he had played on was just phenomenal. Really a super nice guy. And we just became friends. And so when I came across a certain song that I knew how he played, I would recruit him to play drums on it. He would come up. We'd spend, like I said, 35 minutes or an hour just laughing and having jokes. He'd go out and take three passes. Fantastic. It's just, there's a level of, do you know what there was before there were Pro Tools?
Sure. Yeah, tape.
Pros. Guys that
Oh,
could
yeah,
play,
true.
write, and sing. Just pros. You didn't need auto tune. You didn't need time correction. You just, and Jim's one of those guys. You just, wherever the pocket is, he is solid in the pocket. So, yeah, that's what
But
there was before Pro Tools.
he's a guy like Ringo or like Steve Gadd that like these guys just make it look easy. It's fascinating to watch those guys play.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's easy for them. They know how to relax and play. I mean, Gad's come over and played on a couple of tracks in my house. I've never worked with Ringo, but he's such a simple drummer, much like Henley is, but his feel and pocket is just absolutely solid. You know, not overly complicated. It's not flashy. It's just solid rock pocket.
Well, Don, congrats on this record, and thank you so much for the time. Always good.
You got it. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon. All right,
Sounds good.
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.